Thanks for coming to our talk. We're really excited about this. There's a bit of echo actually on there, isn't there?
Might just be the room.
Yeah. So just making sure you can all hear okay. So good, thank you. I'm John Rogers. I'm from the University of Dundee in Scotland. And whoop. Sometime last August, after receiving some funding for a project from the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council in the UK to explore the future of this technology, which Kate will be telling you about in a minute, we kind of had a bit of a brainstorm of, kind of, let's go for South by Southwest, let's put a punt in. And we put a few ideas in, and this one stuck. So thank you if you voted for it. And again, we got invited to come back. So this has been kind of a thing, 8 months in preparation, several pubs, a gallery and an exhibition and a plane ride, and we've got it all together. So here we are today. So think of us as a kind of a... Can we turn that up a bit?
We weren't an experience test, we want to use it to go in the instruction manual, cheap and simple. We've got the infrastructure to put in the manual. It's probably only changed somewhere in the name of the instruction. I'm not sure if people have heard of the fancy instruction, but I'm really interested in the potential of making new musical. Push the boundaries of the listener experience. The problem is that I think it could be quite gimmicky.
What's it about for everybody? What's it about for the maker, the producer, the consumer, the user, the viewer? All these people are going to have printed electronics in their lives in some form in the next 6 months to 10 years.
Thank you. So we're here to answer the question of, can printed electronics save the music industry? This is us. We're kind of a collection of a ragtag group of fugitives fleeing from Scotland to Austin to find out whether paper is actually the future or not. And this is really, for us, it's very much a debate. We really want you to get involved with it. These are kind of the people that are involved, as you can see, lots of different sources of funding. We're particularly grateful to the Foreign Commonwealth Office for giving us a rather large amount to come and for us to be here. So thank you to them. So, why are we here? Why are you here? What's paper doing? So we're going to be starting to answer these questions and really looking at, you know, in a time where we've got digital photo frames, the paperless office, the cashless society, we see the papers actually, the trend is to be removed. And what we're looking at is really is, we're all looking in this direction. And maybe just for this hour, if you could just maybe look that way or that way, but not in a standard kind of forward-looking potentially of how people think the internet is going to go and come into our lives. So stick with us. We're going to take you on a little bit of a journey for the next hour and give you some examples of how that's going to happen. So I'm John Rogers.
And I'm Kate Stone from a company called Novalio in Cambridge, UK.
Well, my name's Kenny Anderson. I am a singer-songwriter known as King Creosote, and I run a small record label in Fife in Scotland called Fence Records.
My name's Tommy Perman. I'm an artist and musician, and I'm part of a collective called Found, and we make experimental artwork and music.
My name is Pete Thomas. I'm a futures director at a brand communications agency called Uniform.
Okay, so this brings us on really to the start of it. So what's here? Why are we here? And I think to start that, we're going to say, well, let's, before we go into the music part of it, let's just say, well, what is printed electronics? So I don't know how many of you know at the moment, show of hands, how many of you know what printed electronics is? Cool. Okay, so let's make sure we're on the same message at the end. So I'm going to pass over to Kate Stone now, who's going to talk a bit more about that.
Okay, thanks. Well, so my background is sort of electronics and in physics, and then I created a company called Novalio, and we've been working on printed electronics. I started it about 7 years ago, but more recently, the last few years, we've built it to a company of 10. And when people ask me what when people ask me what I do, I find it really, really hard to explain. So I actually don't really know how to describe what print electronics is. I find it incredibly difficult because it can be so many different things. So the best way I found to do this usually is to do it sort of by example and showing some concepts and showing some things. But I'll start off just by saying a little bit about what some of the components are. And I just also mentioned yesterday, I was really lucky to go to the Al Gore talk, and I was in the front three rows, which was amazing. And part of the theme through what he kept on mentioning was about the printing press and about how the printing press took us from serfdom to help to create a democracy. And that's what printing's done over the years, and it's enabled a massive revolution in communications. But the other massive revolution we've had in communications is to do with electronics. And so much of electronics is actually still made by hand and assembled in large factories in Asia. So what I'm really fascinated by is using the processes of printing and converting, which is laminating, and so how to use machines to put things together without using necessarily people to do it, to create electronics, and then we can have electronics low cost, far more ubiquitous, and can help to change things, I think, for a lot of people. So for me, it's about combining conventional electronics, so silicon chips, low cost devices that are all out there and available, with print, the means to print, and the way to put that together. And through print, we can do things like put capacitive touch, which is, you know, the sort of thing you get on an iPad, into a poster, into a piece of packaging, and start to make things become interactive. But the exciting thing is not doing that by a million people in a factory making these that are all the same. It's by doing it with print facilities, which are in any city in the world. So to print conductive inks onto materials and start to make them interactive without the electronics bit, that can be done in any city in the world. There'll be printing presses that can be done on, and that bit is really, really exciting. I think this just shows one of the printing presses that we work with. So you can run printing presses at, you know, a few hundred metres a minute or so. So you can make things really quite quickly. Changing plates, tooling costs low. So what the bit we do that's kind of different, though, is we weave conductive inks in amongst the graphics. So you've got a piece of graphic art, now you have conductive inks in it. This just shows a circuit diagram, which I create, and then we turn that into graphics. So all the silver line art in that image is actually silver. And I create the circuit. First of all, we create a design, and then in Photoshop, just rub little bits out and allow the circuit to flow into design. And it's really important that design comes first. So although I'm an electronic engineer, the first person I hired is a graphic designer, and she made this, and I think it's really beautiful. It was to me as an engineer, because I could never do that. And then we made this greetings card that is interactive. So when you pick it up, it knows that you've touched it, and so the candles light up. When the candles light up, you blow them out, but they never all go out at the same time, because that's what happens, right? So you have to blow again, and then it plays Happy Birthday. And the breath sensor was something we discovered by accident, just when someone breathed on the ink, because they were having a bad day, and they just sort of sighed, because they couldn't stick some LEDs down. So it's kind of creating that interactive experience, and making things become something they weren't necessarily before. So this is a cookie carton that we've turned into a toy. So you could imagine, is it packaging or is it a toy? Which one is it? Does it have life beyond when it would normally be thrown away? So if this was a Happy Meal box without the toy, but it's paper, you haven't had to injection mold lots of these things in Asia and deal with the plastic and all the environmental issues of that. We've just made it out of paper. But which is it, toy or carton? We do things a bit more serious as well. So this is a pharmaceutical carton that has conductive tracks in it. So when you take the tablets, it knows when you took them, and it helps to remind you when to take your next tablets, and you've got a little Am I There Yet button that you can press to find out, is it time yet? But it monitors that, and it can let the healthcare professionals know when medication was actually taken or not. This is a tissue carton that we created with a packaging company in the US, and everyone knows no tissue carton is complete without a piano on the side. but we created this with a company who were doing trials on this and looking at whether the market's interested. They print a quarter of a trillion cartons a year here in the US. But the idea is to put a toy functionality into the carton, because they said it would drive sales of what is a tissue carton at a gas station. This is a poster we've made for a bar. So basically asks you a series of questions to analyse your personality. You touch it and it talks to you. So what describes you best? What hat would you wear? Where would you go on vacation? Then it analyses your personality and recommends one of 30 vodka cocktails so you kind of know what to drink. This is a poster we've created for... Am I okay for time?
You're fine. Another minute or two.
Oh, okay.
A minute.
Okay. this is something we've created for in school. So at the moment, all of these are demos, but we're working with partners. So we don't create products of our own. We're creating things with partners who want to trial these things. And this has a story of a life of a kid called Tyler. And you can touch it, and there's a dialogue opens up about his life and what choices he might make. So the children who are playing with this would be are faced with choices. Do they go off with the kids on the corner, or do they go off to town on their own? Do they set fire to a skip, or do they not? Do they show their music to someone that they've got on their MP3 that they've met? And, you know, so the six life outcomes, which vary from kind of going to prison for a long while for something later on in life to becoming a pop star and some kind of quite boring things in between. So for us... Okay, that's it, really. So for us, really, it's all about combining the power of electronics with the pervasiveness of print and making everyday things interactive.
Wow. You get that? You got where we're sitting, you got what we're doing, and what the technology can do. So now we're going to take just a little bit of a tangent, and we're going to go to King Creosote, Kenny Anderson, to tell you a little bit about his view, his very passionate view on the music industry. So I'm going to put this question to him, really. Does the music industry need to be saved? Should it be saved? And really, what is it about music?
Well, I think to boldly claim that this will save the music industry, we have an amazing double positive in Scotland. It's aye right. So my initial reaction is aye right. And then Tommy said, but actually there's more people here to hear you at a printed electronics lecture than there were last year when you actually played South by Southwest. So it's probably saved my career. Excellent. No, my whole shtick, I have a record label in Scotland, so I've basically put together a few graphs, and it's basically how music has been devalued over the last 15 years. Sorry?
We're going to go on to that bit in a minute. Okay, 1982.
Yeah, just let me go.
Yeah,
right, so I'm starting in 1982 because that's when I started to buy music. I started to buy music as a 15-year-old. I got into... like, not chart music, but sort of indie music. And back then, we had about five or six record shops in St Andrews, and I was spending about £5.49, at the time, £5.49, on an LP or a cassette. By 1992, I had a band, I had a bluegrass band, and we got signed, and we did all the touring, and we did everything that you do in a band. And by that point, the CD had arrived, and the CDs were £14 in the shop, and a cassette would be £8. By 2002, that had all fallen apart, and I had a record shop, and it went nosedive right into the ground because we couldn't compete with the supermarkets. We couldn't compete with Napster and the supermarkets. So by this point, the internet had arrived. Students were able... We were primarily in a university town. Students were able to basically copy each other's music at a great rate of knots, and then have the cheek to sell us back the empty cases, which we bought. There you go. And then right up to 2012, where I've got a record label called Fence Records, and we've basically decided that vinyl for us is the only optional, it's the only option to get value into our tracks. We tried doing CDs, we tried doing everything, and tried to follow the curve, and I was never happy with it. So we're basically a website, and we sell vinyl. And we try and add value to the vinyl by tying it in with live shows. So I got a few graphs together, and I did all this myself, by the way. So this is the price that fuel has taken since 1982. It's gone up quite well there. And then I've got house prices since 1982. And then I've got music since 1982. Oh dear. Now, that looks like a house and a gallon of fuel on an album cost exactly the same back in 1982, but in methyl
was advanced.
In methyl and five, you'd get a much cheaper house. So Yeah, I'm contesting this on, it's basically a value, this is my thing, it's about value. I'm from the old school, I honestly think less is more. I think we're going down the wrong route if we start making cheaper and more disposable items. I don't think the planet needs us all to have everything. I don't think it does a band any favours that you have a few megabytes amongst gigabytes on a laptop. And I've struggled for the last sort of 15, 20 years as a musician against this tide of music should be free for all and that somehow there will be a payback at live gigs. It's bullshit. The industry is on its knees, and I honestly think that this cannot save that industry because there's the internet here and everybody except me loves it. I'm not online, by the way, either. Heinous.
I'm proud.
I'm proud to not be online. I just don't think it can save the industry, but can it offer an alternative industry? I can't answer that. So
I told you it was a debate. So kind of keep tweeting and keep thinking about this. We want Kenny's comments captured in digital for him not to see because he won't check, so you can say what you want. Okay, so we're going to kind of take another perspective here, which is Tommy and what the work that they've been doing with their kind of collective found. So really posing this question of how do you connect with your community, this kind of sense of hyper-localness. So Tommy, what do you do to connect with your audiences?
Well, obviously this is a recent press shot of found. You can work out which one is me. No, this was actually a competition that we ran last year to engage our audience in Scotland, and we worked with a local listings magazine called The Skinny to run a competition to win tickets to our album launch and a copy of the album. And this was one of the winners, a girl who made egg versions of myself and the other two band members. She seemed to love the project so much that she sent us the next picture. She turned us into omelettes. I like the dead eyes there. But yeah, this is kind of just a bit of a shorthand for how we attempt to engage with our audience and add extra value to what we do. We're actually an arts collective who specialise in doing exhibitions and interactive sound installations, as well as making, broadly speaking, pop music.
So that leads us perfectly onto the kind of this sense of something being music and beyond the instruments you're playing on. You know, why do we need a physical world? Why why do we need music and things that we can connect with that need to be physical? So Tommy's going to kind of continue with this line.
Yeah. Okay, this is our latest project, which is called Unravel. And you can see it's like a really sculptural, physical installation. It's got a record player at the heart of it, and then these mechanical musical instruments around about it, and they're self-playing instruments. And visitors to the exhibition can choose a real 7-inch record, one of 10. You can see there's a record box. Sorry, if you... John's skipping ahead there.
Sorry,
you can choose a record and put it on the turntable, and then all the mechanical musical instruments spring to life. And it's definitely a physical experience. You need to be there in person to get it. I'll let you play that little video now.
Yeah, just keep jumping in.
So the installation actually has a variety of sensors on it, and when you put the needle down on the record, you will hear a different version of this story played to you. And the story is being narrated by a Scottish writer called Aidan Moffat, who was the lead singer or spoken word artist in a very successful Scottish band called Arab Strap, who are sadly no more. But we've been collaborating with him. And this installation acknowledges people in the gallery, so it reacts differently if there's more people there. So there's quiet versions of all the stories and busy versions of all the stories. And you can also tweet your opinion of the installation, and that will affect the confidence of the narrator. So if you say kind things about the installation, the narrator becomes confident and remembers the stories in a different way. But if you slag or say negative things about the... I have to...
Scrub that from the record, please.
I have to remember how to communicate here. But yeah, if you say negative things about the installation, then the confidence of the narrator falls and you get an insecure story. So you definitely couldn't do this as nicely with a digital format. You could definitely do it with a website or an app, but we've found that building physical installations like this really engages the audience, and we've had much more success. People want to come back and spend a lot of time exploring the artwork, and I think that's something that's key. And the point that I would like to get across at this panel is that physical objects have a lot more engagement potential than digital alone. I think combining digital technology and new technologies with traditional techniques makes for something really exciting.
Thanks, Tommy.
And lastly, a kind of another little silly side project that we did. We released our last single as a playable chocolate record. This was kind of gimmicky, but it did actually play. We collaborated with a bakery in Fife, and we kind of just goaded the guy on to see if it was possible to make this, and amazingly he achieved an edition of 50 playable 7-inch records, which we sold very quickly. So physical still works.
Exactly, and actually you can follow up more on this on the NASA website, on the Open Space Challenges, where we're looking at a project about making and baking, but that's another talk for next year. Plug. So Pete, we've kind of set this scene of why print electronics. What is it about the music industry, and why make music physical? Just to, before we get to the paper and the paper apps part of it, I want Pete to talk to us a little bit about what happens when you connect the internet to something physical, and it's something that we kind of collectively calling physical apps. Pete, did you want to take?
Yeah.
Pete did the slide, so I'm going to let him run through this bit.
Okay, so a little while ago, John and I live in the same village in Anstruther, where Kenny lives as well. And
it's a village trip, this, by the way.
Yeah. And, you know, in the pub, John and I would kind of often talk about design, and I'm a brand, you know, I have a brand communications agency, but I'm trained as a product designer, and I've kind of fallen into lecturing on and off over the last 12 years. And John kind of rekindled my excitement about product design by introducing me to kind of this idea of digital product design, and we came up with this concept of physical apps and what those mean. And the kind of context that we decided for them is that they were objects that connect to the internet to perform dedicated tasks, but without you having to use a kind of standard interface medium like a touchscreen or a mouse or a keypad. And working around that, I kind of wanted to work out, you know, we did a lot of work with our students in the university, and exploring how product design reacts to that kind of brief. But I wanted to understand how brand communications reacts to that brief as well. So I kind of brought this back in-house into Uniform, and we wanted to explore how we could connect our studio to our Twitter followers. Because, I mean, I really, really enjoy using Twitter, and we use it quite a lot as a communication platform for our company. But when we get a new follower, nobody else in the studio knows about that. You know, we have kind of a couple of us who access the account and tweet on behalf of the company, but nobody else sees what happens. Nobody else gets any of that kind of enjoyment. So we wanted to make a machine that basically told the office when somebody followed us on Twitter. So this is Sweet Tweet, and I'll show you a little film of it. Thank you. So it's a glorious one-liner, which I'm completely unapologetic for it. I would probably have moaned at a student about it, but it's fine for the studio. So that sits in the corner of our studio, and every time somebody follows us, we send them the film. Twitter is actually a terrible API to use for it because it really wasn't the right thing to do, but we learned that as we went along with so much of this stuff. So that's kind of, you know, a physical app. I think that's...
That's you, yeah. That's, so now we're going to get into the heart of the talk, which is really why paper. So we've shown that we want to connect music to kind of give it a physical sense, connect it to the internet to gain audience reach. So why kind of, this is working great, Sweet Treats is really cool, got all over the web, Wired covered it and so on. So why are we talking about paper? So back to Tommy, because he's going to show a couple of things that he's been working on with my PhD student, Mike Shorter, who's funded by Novalia, to really look at this idea of paper. So can you just go back into paper again, please, for us, Tommy?
Yeah, sure. So I showed you that project that we've done, Unravel, which is obviously a big sculptural project, and you couldn't easily sell that to lots of people. You couldn't make tons of copies of that, and you know, unless people wanted to buy a £40,000 sound installation. So we were really interested in the potential of paper electronics and, well, paper apps and printed electronics, of bringing some of these kind of interactive ideas into a low-cost, potentially mass-producible product, a new musical product. So I've been working with Mike on a couple of...
Where is Mike? You can...
Mike's somewhere. There he is.
It's his birthday, too.
We've been working on these physical versions, kind of small ideas, versions of the big project that we've done. So this is a 7-inch record sleeve that has 4 volume faders on it, and you can actually do your own mix of the track, and it really works. You can plug headphones into this paper sleeve, and you have 4 volume controls there, one with the vocals, one with the keyboard part, the percussion, and the chimes. So if you don't like the way that I've mixed it, you just do your own mix. And then the next slide.
And we're happy for people to come and play with these demonstrators at the end. That would be really, really useful for us if you can stick around and come and break these demonstrators for us.
Yeah, we'll either go outside. We got moved on trying to do this yesterday, but I'm sure there's a friendly bar that we can pop in and try these out later.
Okay, and this next slide uses a different aspect of the project that I showed you. The narrator, Aidan Moffat, is well known for his explicit content. He uses quite adult themes, not friendly for everybody. So we decided that we wanted to do a kind of parental advisory product. So this has a light sensor in it, and if it's daylight hours, you hear the kind of clean version, the family-friendly version. But as soon as it gets nighttime, he'll be cursing a little bit and saying some rude things. So this is a physical release that has its own inbuilt censorship.
Okay, so now we're going to get into it. We're going to say we connected the internet, made it physical, looked at the value of paper, and playing around putting digital electronics into paper. So what about this concept of a paper app? You know, we're starting to push it a bit beyond probably the boundaries of what we can do right now, but we're really excited, actually, about what could happen next. So, Pete, do you want to go into paper apps for us?
Okay, I mean, paper in itself is a paper app, really. We've been chasing around these bohemian guys who are handing out these really lovely notebooks around town, which are, like, perfect examples of, like, traditional paper apps. And I'm sure this term is open to a fair amount of abuse. It can mean lots of different things to different people. But for us, it's essentially the same as a physical app. You know, we're talking about connecting to services, data, information, products, supported by an infrastructure of the web, but through a medium of paper. And Kate's explained why paper, really. You know, the infrastructure for printing is global. We don't need to change it at all. The medium is understood throughout the world and has been used for hundreds of years. So it's a really interesting platform to start to experiment with. And we've created a couple of demonstrators that start to, you know, specifically address the question of how printed electronics could have an impact on the music industry. And what's interesting about these is that they're not so much answers to questions as questions. And certainly kind of making them and bringing them here and getting people playing with them has been really exciting to kind of better understand where the opportunities are for them and how they can develop. So one of the first things we did, I mean, a typical way for us working in our agency is we'll sit down at the start of a project and try and kind of bash out 100 ideas as quickly as possible. And a lot of those can be quite throwaway, but some of them kind of really stick. And one of the concepts that excited me quite a lot was this idea of postcards, digital postcards that played individual single tracks. I still can't really explain why it excited me. There's a curious thing about digital singles. You know, they take up, I think it's 99% of single sales in the UK last year was digital. It's made a huge impact. And they have a kind of semi-disposability to them. You know, people, this is kind of what Kenny's rallying against, really, is that people are no longer buying albums, they're buying individual tracks, they're browsing for music and picking and choosing what they want. And I had this mental image in my head of people in corner shops looking at those kind of racks of postcards and filtering through them. And to me, it felt analogous to kind of the idea of kind of browsing through vinyl, and you might look for music in the same way, or that you might go to somewhere like Anstruther, which is a very pretty kind of rural fishing village.
And, we also run a B&B.
Yeah, and you might buy the postcard, but you'd want to hear the sound of the village as well and take that with you and give it to somebody. And printed electronics offers the opportunity to do that at kind of relatively low cost. So this is the postcard player. I've got a very quick film.
This is music from Found.
Okay, so it's a very basic concept, but the important thing about these is essentially this is dumb paper. It's not smart paper. There's nothing on it apart from conductive ink. What you've done is create just a very simple touch interface. It needs to dock into something. So this is where we're at now. This is where I think commercially, in terms of viability, this is hugely commercial because there's actually no electronics on there. There's just ink. It just happens to be conductive ink. And then in this case, we're docking it with a box with an Arduino in it and using kind of copper connectors to direct the Arduino which tracks to play. And we're planning on kind of making that open source so that people can make their own postcard players. And I have this dream in my head that somebody might send me a little mixtape that they've made on a postcard so that I can play it on my postcard player. The other slightly more commercial kind of demonstrator that we came up with, and we worked with Kate closely at Novalia on this, is this idea of a kind of a gig listing poster but updated. And this kind of came out of a conversation that I was having with Kenny where he was instructing me on the woes of the music industry. And I was really trying to understand, well, what might actually make a difference? You know, what could feasibly have some impact? And we were talking about live music, and it struck me that if I was in Austin, for example, what I'd really want to do is know what the band sounded like. So often with live music, you might not know who's playing at a smaller gig. And so the idea behind this is that you can press on the listings and you'll hear a sample of who'll be playing. And Kate was kind enough to print these up and make the magic work. So we've got one of these to play with as well. And the exciting thing about this is, you know, it's really low cost, but you can see where you could go to next with it. So at the moment, it just plays a track, but it's relatively simple for Kate to connect that to the internet. And if you connect it to the internet, it means that potentially you can then buy the tickets for the gig, or you can download the music, or you can tell it to share more music to you, and actually create an experience whereby the poster kind of becomes part of a bigger ecosystem of music consumption that takes in things like Spotify and iTunes. So I think this is a fairly feasible vision of how paper electronics could kind of seek its way into our everyday lives and have an impact on the music industry. I just wanted to say, I mean, generally this concept of physicality, it's been really interesting coming here. There was a great talk. Did anyone catch the David Eagleman talk about the brain and his book Incognito? Thank you to the man in the back. It was a fantastic talk about neuroscience, and I had one of those days where I was slightly hungover and caught about four talks back to back that all seemed to say the same interesting things about neuroscience. And John and I have often talked about people, you know, the perception of the internet, and this is the shape of the internet. This is a John Rogers phrase that I'm shamelessly stealing here, but this is the shape of the internet we experience. It's rectangular. I don't want to experience the richness that's out there on the same screen day after day. You know, when I kind of get an email from my kids, I don't want to experience it the same way that I get an email from work, and I don't think I should have to. So to me, this kind of touchscreen hegemony that we live in at the moment is like it's a beautiful reductionist vision where we access all this rich information through one medium. But the one that I think we'll actually have in the future is a maximalist kind of vision where there'll be bits of dirty data in everything all around us, and we will pick and choose how we want to consume that. And can I just very quickly?
Very quickly.
Very quickly. So the thing about in terms of people's engagement, one of the things that was interesting from all these neuroscientists was, you know, there's clear evidence that the physicality of objects creates a different experience in people's brains. You know, data, human brains weren't designed to compute data that floats in space. We respond differently when we pick something up and when we hold it in our hands and when we touch it. So for me, embedding digital into the physical everyday stuff that around us is a necessary progression for us to create more engaging interactions with that information.
I think that's really interesting. So I run a product design course in Dundee, and I'm kind of a bit worried actually about the future. You can imagine the future of a course, can't you? Because if you think of, just cast your minds back to the past, if you said radio, TV or book, you got something physical. But if you said something like YouTube, Spotify or Kindle, everything's a square. So my new course that I'm going to be starting running in September is going to be week one, design a rectangle. Week two, make it shiny. Week three, graduate, thanks very much, go and get a job. You know, or we start to think about this. And it's interesting because I was out in India doing this and talking to students there. And I think they've really got that, and they're really passionate about the idea of, hold on, we can own our media. We're product designers. We're not going to hand it over to all the other type of designers to do this. So what I love about South by Southwest, and we're moving on to our final bit here, is you get to see the future. And we saw it. It was there. I can't remember exactly because it was out of a bar when we came out, but there she is, the DeLorean, and all set to go and ready to go and revving up for the future. So the future is here. That's not for me. That's from the streets.
I feel slightly, you know, obviously outnumbered here, but they've shown you all these amazing gadgets and nobody has said how much the musicians will get for the application of their art and the destruction of their art.
Well,
and
Kenny,
the taking away of their... It's fine if you can do that with your own music, but I have to say that if Sgt. Pepper came out in 1967 and you could remix, i.e. take out Ringo... you are going to go home, even if music was in every lamppost and you could choose light by touching it and all of that, you will still go home and take Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, if you like that album, put it on, sit in a dark room in your living room and let the music take you wherever it goes. You don't need visuals, you certainly don't need like flashing lights, you do not need things that move, that, and also the music on this stuff sounds terrible. It is the worst sounding advert for music that ever, ever, ever was made. So keep music away from it. Use everything else. Like, put sugar on it, because that's terrible. Put McDonald's fat on there. That's terrible. Get all that stuff from paper electronics, but leave music alone.
And we'll continue from that point, if we can.
You needed to say that.
I had to get that out.
Give Kenny a hug, please, audience.
I mean, will it put bands on the road? Will it help bands from Scotland play all around Canada? Will it give people jobs taking, you know, photographs and writing about music? And will it? answer those questions instead of blinding me with your science.
So you might know Kenny's argument already. We started this in a pub, like we said, last August, and we're probably going to continue probably for another 3 years until we prove him wrong. So what's next? I'm going to go back to Kate, because Kate's the expert here. We've taken a lot of her technology and we've kind of played around with it and we've made physical things. So I want Kate to start to show you a vision, two visions really, of what we can do now. You know, so if you were going to say, well, I want to do this, I want to employ Kate to start to make some products, what could you have today? And then we're going to look at some kind of demonstrators of the future. So Kate, what's happening now?
Okay, so... So everything, what we do now is based around piece of print, traditional chip, on a PCB, stuck on the piece of print, and that enables us to write some software on that piece of print, run an app, and start to make the physical apps, some of the things that have been described. So in working with the other guys, some of the things that have been created, one of them is a pair of paper headphones. So
modelled by Tom Metcalf, who's over here.
Oh, put them on and then stroll around. No. And I think there are some, and we brought a whole bunch of them in sheet form that people can actually make their own headphones. And they have conductive inks in them, and then some speakers are in them, and so you have a pair of paper headphones.
We will be giving some of these out afterwards if you're really keen. To the man there. Just give him some right now, Mike.
another thing that's been created is...
So this is where we start to look at the future, actually. So so effectively, what we have now, and we could make these in a product, and they could come off a printing press. There's still some work to do. So this is where Kate and I and others on a research project, Interactive Newsprint, and other sites grants, are looking at how you could maybe make something completely wireless, okay? Designed by Tom Metcalf, who was modelling earlier. He's not just a model. And...
He's not even a model.
Okay. We'll just quickly play the video of this one. Who was at Jay-Z last night? You might recognise that. And the other one was a taxi on Saturday, I think, home. So really this idea of where we're at is you can't actually print... your internet radio. It's quite thick ink, there's bits coming off, but the point is, and this is where I'm going to hand back to Kate, that we can demonstrate its functionality. For you, the audience, that's how you test and experience prototype what the future could be like. But there's a fair bit of tech engineering to go on, and Kate, can you just continue us on a bit of that journey of where that's going to go in the next 6 months to 5 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, more like on the sort of like 1 to 2 year timescale. So whilst we can create... these demonstrators, we can turn those into products when they're based around a chip on a board, and that can create a product that can be sold now. But in terms of making things thinner and in terms of making things lower cost, what we're working on is how we can take a bare silicon die. So we can get a silicon die that's kind of like, it's the size of kind of a grain of sand, really. And on that die, we're working with some dies that are the same processor that were used for the Apple II, but that die costs less than 10 cents, and it's really amazing to think what you can start to do with that. So what we're working on now is how to take that die, embed that into a piece of print, print some resistors, print some capacitors, perhaps use a printed battery, and a printed speaker. And how to create something that's kind of like more like a sticker, more kind of like you don't have. There's not holograms on the banknotes in the US here, but usually I say, you know, like a hologram that's stamped onto something. That could be a circuit. So maybe something like 1 inch square that's a sticker and as thin as a piece of paper that has some silicon chips in there and has the software on that. We want to create that as a platform that then can...
When do you think that's going to come? When can we get these stickers?
In terms of us developing the technology, we're working on that net right now, and we should start to have things ready in like 1 or 2 year timescale. And so, I mean, what I really believe is that one day we're going to wake up and all of the technology, you know, the phone that you mentioned, it will have just gone. And it's like almost like quiet. All the technology is just disappeared.
And Kenny wouldn't have come in and stolen it. This is...
But the thing is, it's gone, right? And where it's gone is into everything that's around us, making it disappear into every object, chairs, tables, walls, carpets. And then it's there for you to use or not use. So if you don't want to use it, it's fine. It's
hold
absolutely
on.
Fine.
If you don't want to use it, stand up all day.
So I'm a bit nervous about this bit because we've got 14 minutes to go. Kenny, what do you think the future is of this? What's the future of the music industry? Tell it straight.
Okay. I think this is fine for if there's a mass market decides that they want music for free and they want it cheap and they want it coming out of the chair and they want it piped at them in cabs and all of that, well, they can have that. But don't destroy it for those of us who still value an album. We still try and make a living playing music. We still try and, A, create our art and have it heard in the way that we want. I mean, you don't sell a painting with a white border and offer paints to finish it. You buy the artist's work. That is the whole point in this, and I think this is taking away. I think the whole thing is becoming like the people who are pushing this technology want to meddle with everything else. So music was the first. That was the first industry to buckle. Then we've had photographers out of work. Now we've got the whole publishing industry is going to come clattering down, and it takes up, it consumes everything. And until you work out how to have everything through these ridiculous machines, I mean, they're just calculators. What are we thinking? Annoyed by emails all day and... Yeah, horrible. The future is awful.
According to Kenny. So for maybe a slightly lighter note, we're going to go over to Tommy Perman from Found.
Shut up, Grandad.
Basically, my opinion is that new technology historically has gone hand in hand with music and given rise to new musical styles. So the introduction of technology, every time something a new bit of kit is invented, a new bit of equipment, we have a new musical style given birth, you know, and I think that's left us with a really rich variety of styles of music that you wouldn't have without technology. Music and technology need each other. And I think with this kind of technology, printed electronics, we could embrace a whole new format of music, and it could allow musicians and artists to be incredibly creative and create genuinely new things, you know, stuff that hasn't been thought of before. And that excites me a hell of a lot. So I'm looking forward to the opportunities that new technology gives. And I think there will be possibilities to earn some money, but just not in the way that it has been done in the past.
So, coming up to the end here, I'm just going to really say to the panel, we'll do one-word answers. Choose a binary option. Tommy, can printed electronics save the music industry?
Sadly, no.
Kenny?
Definitely not.
Kate?
Hang on, they're saying two words. Yeah,
that's fine. It's Scotland, you can imagine. Hey, no one in the audience has heard more than one word then.
I'll say no. No.
And Pete?
Just maybe.
Personally, I think it's going to rock. So a quick show of hands from the audience. Can printed electronics save the music industry? Put your hands up if you think aye, which is yes. One, two, three. I think we've totally convinced you for a re-gig next year. Thank you very much. That's absolutely fantastic. This is our Twitter IDs. Apart from Kenny, but pass them through to us. He does have a Twitter account, and there's 436 people following him, and he's made no tweets.
I'm not on Twitter. Somebody took
so
the name.
So please follow him. If we get up to 1,000, he might say, go away.
My friend took the name to make sure nobody else got that. I have 400 followers on a thing that I've never been near. It's amazing. That says it all, really.
So I'd really like to take some questions. Why don't you come up the front? And just, it's all this. I can't spot you. So first three people up the front will get to ask a question.
Have you considered using this for radio production?
For radio.
I'm a radio reporter, that's why I ask.
Right, that's a good idea.
If I can answer on behalf of Tom and the wireless radio, so this technology is basically powered by AudioBoo. So what you can do is if you've got the app, and this is kind of working now, if you've got the app, and Tom will demonstrate it in a minute, maybe, you can capture sound from your mobile device, and it will basically be relayed to the radio automatically. And where this is particularly interesting for some of John's research in terms of interactive newsprint and how it might affect communities is that effectively you're making kind of community radios and community broadcasting. So John and Paul, who's sat over here, have been doing a lot of kind of community journalism, really. How do you turn people in communities into journalists who document the life around them and use that as a design tool and a design method to make the communities better?
Well, we're basically calling it inside journalism. I've got some stuff here I can hand out afterwards about that. But think of a community newsletter. What if that was a radio? People love print, and but if you can combine those two mediums. So, yes, and can we talk to you afterwards, please, at any point? Thank you.
Kenny, can you imagine a future that would include a poster where someone could walk up and touch it and listen to your music and therefore be encouraged to go and buy a ticket to come to your concert?
Well, that would depend on how many bigger bands had bigger and brighter posters. You'd still need an industry of some sort to direct people to my own gig. So it would be, would there be a queue of people at that poster waiting to hear it? I don't think so. I don't think... what if it rains on that poster? I mean, electronics is great and you get it wet and then nothing works.
Yeah, don't mention water.
Oh, sorry, I've mentioned the water word.
Yeah, and particularly because we're based in Scotland. Okay, have we got another question coming here? Yeah, yes. Thank you.
So looking at a lot of the things you're showing, seems one of the limiting factors seems to be batteries. If you look at your wireless thing, you've got the large batteries there on the back of it. Your postcards, printed postcards, you've got to see them actually in the player to play them. I know Kate mentioned printed batteries, I believe, one time. So my question is, I guess, directed towards you, since you seem to be one with the most experience in that. Where do you see printed batteries going, and how soon do you think we'll actually have them to be able to use for everyone?
Okay, so there are printed batteries available, and they are in some products. The problem is, basically, is the cost. So at the moment, printed batteries cost a few tens of cents, whereas a button cell or a coin cell costs a cent or a few cents. So it really is down to cost. I mean, they do have sort of lifetime issues as well, but they have enough to run quite a few things. We've done a poster that's on... we have a poster that's connected to the internet, so when you touch the poster, it updates a web page. So it's kind of like taking the internet to a poster. That's using what we do, instead of not just worry about the battery, but we look at how much power we use. So that's using low-power Bluetooth and uses less than a milliamp. So we could definitely run that from a printed battery.
Have you been involved in the development of those batteries, and if not, who are the main people that are?
So we partner with a company in Cleveland called Blue Spark Technologies. They develop printed batteries, and they have the capability of printing millions of batteries, and they're sort of increasing their capability to do that at the moment. But it's kind of like, I think that they're looking for using it in things like smart cards, so how to put power into a smart card, that type of application.
Great.
I work for a traditional print publisher, and I'm finding a lot of this really fascinating, and I'm wondering if you've approached any publishing companies about incorporating this technology into sort of like limited edition, you know, books or chap books or any of that kind of thing. And actually, Kenny, to your points about, you know, sort of anti-technology, I mean, I wonder, do you not see that there could be like a potential, like,
we're
going to
do three questions.
Or?
Can we do, I don't mind doing two,
right?
But can we answer the printed one first?
Sure.
About publishers?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to Pete first, because he runs a graphic design agency, and I know Kate's been doing work on that too. So, Pete, have you...
Feel free to go to Kate first.
I'll put over to Kate.
Oh, okay. We've done a demo with a book, and actually, we don't approach any companies. So the way we do stuff is everything that we do is from people who have come to us and said, can you do such and such? And then we kind of explore it, and the ideas come out of that kind of us having empathy for what someone's saying their issues are, what they want to try to create, and then we kind of do the magic bit of like looking at what technology we've got and how we can make that happen. So we don't kind of like go out and approach people, but someone like yourself who's interested in doing stuff, we can explore and see what's feasible. You know, is it the right price point? Does it create the right experience? So we've created a hardback book. So it looks like a normal book. We don't want it to look like a special book with a whole bit of plastic on the side. And in the back, you can type in codes that come from the different pages, plug your headphones into the book, and actually listen to audio extras. So there might be, like, in it, an interview with the Beatles, and the interviewer in this demo says, this is like in 1965 or whenever, I don't know it is, says why you're called the Beatles, and then you hear them in their accents saying why they're called the Beatles, and it is amazing to hear that. There's a lunar landing, and you actually hear Neil Armstrong saying one small step for man. And then one thing you can't do in a book, we've done one of the pages, is for meditation. And as soon, and I try to buy a book of meditation, as soon as you touch the thing, it says, close your eyes. You can't do that and read a book at the same time. So we kind of explored that as well.
We'll be running meditation classes later on.
Yeah.
Okay. And then just the quick question to Kenny about, you know, like having this sort of printed electronic technology as a subscription model. So, you know, you have your fan base, and as the new album goes out, you say if you, you know, put down $40 or $50 or euros or whatever, you'll get all this exclusive content, and it's a more of a collectible item. You know, a lot of publishers are looking at this model as a way of keeping the printed book as a sort of unique objet away from the electronics, okay. And it's a way to increase revenue.
Do this in 30 seconds, yeah. So we can go on to the final.
It's just about the added cost of that. I mean, would you not just buy a book on King Creasel, buy a DVD, and buy a, you know, like a CD that came with it? If the cost of making these things, I don't think it's going to be cheap. I don't know. They never said figures, but I think to print a book like that would cost a lot, and I don't know how much would be left for all the extra work that the musician put in and all those tracks. And none of them have talked about the technology moving on so that you come out with a flash photocopier that just copies every page in that book. You know, technology has this way of you have to keep ahead of it all the time. There's so much spent on R&D, and it's just so disposable that I just think people would rather buy a King Creasel album if they could. Right. If somebody would just please open a shop to sell them and have that thing at a value where it pays for a shopkeeper to sell records. It's not a bad job. It was a great life. I have to say the 80s were amazing, if you've missed them.
Can I just say on cost? We do look at cost, and it's about getting cost as low as possible, but we never focus on cost. Okay. Everything we do has to be about creating value for who we work with. Yep. And I won't work with anyone who only looks at costs. So I'm kind of really passionate about that. I'd rather work with a brand or someone who wants to raise the value of something. I don't like the idea of working with a supermarket or someone who's all about cost and pushing cost down, because that's just a zero-sum game. It's any way we can create value, and whoever it works for. And if it doesn't work for them, doesn't work for you, like, I don't care. Yeah. It's just like, I only want to work with people who want to create value in it.
Cool, I'm liking this. So we got another question.
Yeah,
go for it.
This is a great panel, really exciting and really connected to a lot of my own interests and the things I'm thinking about. And so I hope you don't mind just taking a couple comments, you know, rather than exactly questions.
No, comments are good. It's a research project, so I have a PhD researcher who will write all this down as well.
It's not a research project for me, it's a business.
You know, in terms of the paper is a great medium it's a great archival medium, right? The books last a long time if you take care of them, but it's also a really fragile medium, right? So I guess in terms of the economics of this, I could see it working in this way that is not, you know, maybe it's not ethically the best way, right? But if I go and I buy a postcard with a song on it for $1, that's great. And I go home and I listen to it, and then the next day I put something on it and I wrinkle it and it's destroyed. Then you've got a
quick comment to you.
Again, right?
Do you keep the postcards that your mum sends you?
I keep things.
Yeah, do you throw them out?
Yeah, well, I keep things and I throw some things out. In any case, exactly. What I'm saying is that could be, right, is more disposable, right? And so in a way, better, because once I get a CD and I put it on my computer and then I lose the computer or whatever and I just have the CD again and I never have to make that purchase again. But anyway, but the other thing is this idea about the album and everything you said is really speaking to me, you know, Kenny, about that, right? Even though I'm not, you know, I'm not a Luddite or not saying you are, but but music is so interesting to people. Like, people have such a strong reaction to music, right? It's so personal and like so there's so much desire in it, right? And that when I saw some of these examples, right, of like, sticking the postcard in the machine and it reads it and then it just grabs the sound file off of another thing, or maybe it's controlling something by MIDI or whatever, but that LP and even the cassette, it's doing it in front of you, right? So there's something like poetic about it, right? Like that it's, even though it's embedded in the grooves, it's actually a performance, right? It's a weird way to think about it, but I just wanted to throw that out as an image that if, when we think about music, to think about that, that visceral relationship you have when you're watching it spin around and looking at the album cover or putting the cassette in and wondering if that is, you know, something that this paper interfaces then, you know, that you guys are working on might engage with. Do you have any thoughts on that? Because you were nodding.
Well, I tell you what, this might be one that we carry on, because I thought I actually love the way you summed that up. And thank you. I think that's probably us coming up to our minute so we can play the harp and all relax. But really, thank you. It's been great, and lots of you came, and great questions. See you in the pub.
Thank you.
Thank you.